From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A strong red tide has persisted along the Gulf Coast for months. This bloom has been linked to fish kills, sickened a pair of sea turtles, and even poisoned two manatees in the last week. Coming up, why this tide is lingering, why it's so potent, and the impact it's having on wildlife. Plus, bringing home a pet for the holidays, long considered a bad choice as a gift, shelters are now encouraging holiday shoppers to consider homeless pets. We talk with people from animal shelters in Lee and Collier counties about the changing attitude towards pets as gifts. We'll also talk with an emergency room veterinarian about keeping all pets, new and old, safe during the holiday season. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. It was long considered a bad idea to give a pet as a gift for the holidays. Conventional wisdom said giving a pet means also giving a load of responsibilities, leading to these animals being returned once the newness wore off. Well, it turns out conventional wisdom was wrong in this case. Now shelters are encouraging bringing shelter pets home for the holidays. We'll learn what you need to know if you're thinking of giving a pet as a gift this year. But first, a large bloom of Florida red tide has been persisting in the waters from Pinellas to Collier counties for months. Red tide data from state and federal forecasters show medium to high concentrations of the toxic red algae along nearly 200 miles of Florida's Gulf Coast going back to September. In recent weeks, it's killed off fish, sickened two sea turtles that were later nursed back to health, and even poisoned two manatees in the waters off Sanibel Island in the last week. Joining us to explain how the microscopic algae becomes a health hazard for fish, turtles, manatees, and even people is Dr. Heather Barron, a wildlife biologist with CROW, the Clinic for Rehabilitation of Wildlife, which is located on Sanibel Island. Welcome.
Thank you, Julie.
And joining us by phone to talk about the latest with red tide and what's behind this long-lasting bloom is Dr. Vince Loveco from the Moat Marine Lab in Sarasota. Welcome.
Thank you, Julie.
Red tide along the Gulf Coast. What are you seeing, and is it impacting your life, how you work or play in the waters in Southwest Florida? Call in and share your experiences at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Share on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Tag your questions with the hashtag GCL. Before we get into the details of red tide itself, Dr. Heather Barron with CROW, can you tell us a little bit about these turtles that were affected?
Certainly, sea turtles are one of many animals along the food chain in the ocean that may be affected by red tide. These particular two animals came in extremely depressed, very weakened, have been floating in the water for quite some time. And what we see is that this algal toxin is a toxin that can affect the brain or the nerves in the body. So it's known as a neurotoxin. And these guys were very obviously affected by these nerve toxins as they were very weak and very depressed.
So by weak and depressed, it just slowed everything down?
Or... yeah, very much slowed everything down. In fact, it's not uncommon for us to get sea turtles affected by red tide poisoning in a comatose state.
So they were just kind of floating around and someone saw them and brought them in?
Or? Exactly, yes. They were rescued by boaters and brought in by the Marine Rescue Task Force.
Well, that's it. How did you get them back to health?
Really, it's just a matter of supportive care. Luckily, these toxins are processed by the liver and eventually excreted by the kidneys from the body. So really, it's just a matter of supporting them and hoping them in the meantime that they don't succumb to the toxins themselves.
Mm-hmm. We had a couple of manatees show up last week that had also been affected by this red tide. Can you tell me a little bit about how they were taken to the Miami Seaquarium and they're recovering at this point? But how does a manatee get affected by something like this?
Generally by eating seagrasses from areas that are affected by red tide. So they actually ingest the toxin.
So the toxin is in the grass.
It is. Yep. It's in the water. It's in shellfish. And it can be anywhere sort of along the food chain. So fish may eat it. And then anything that eats fish can be affected or anything that eats sea plants can be affected, like the manatees.
Wow. Dr. Vince Lovko with the Moat Marine Lab, I wanted to take a step back and just ask a quick question. We hear about red tide all the time. I hear about it on the news. I hear it here and there because, you know, we live in this area. But I don't know that many people really know what red tide actually is. Can you explain that?
Yes, I can. So take a even further step back. And so our Florida red tide is part of a worldwide phenomenon known as harmful algal blooms, or HABs, or we also refer to them as HABs. Under this phenomena, phytoplankton, which are single-celled, microscopic plant-like organisms, they can also be colonial or chain-forming, but they accumulate in very high concentrations, sometimes high enough to discolor the water, and these blooms also have a harmful effect. So this harm can come in different ways. It could just be because of the large amount of them, the large biomass. It can reduce the oxygen in the water as these blooms break down and are degraded by bacteria. The large blooms can block sunlight for seagrasses, and some of them can directly damage or clog the gills of fish. But the ones we're more interested in and what we're talking about when we talk about Florida red tide are the ones that produce toxins. And these toxins can harm humans directly and wildlife as well, causing illness and sometimes death. And like I said, this is a worldwide phenomena, and they're caused by different phytoplankton species around the world. So coming back to Florida, our Florida red tide is caused by a bloom-forming phytoplankton known as Karenia brevis, which is a dinoflagellate, and as was already mentioned, it produces a neurotoxin called brevetoxin, which affects the central nervous system. And Karenia brevis is present all the time. We often find it at what we refer to as background concentrations, and it's still producing the toxin, but it's not harmful unless there's a lot of it, which only happens when there's a lot of Karenia brevis cells in the water.
So it's always there?
It's always there, yes.
In some level or another?
In some level or another. We have, there's different categories that we use to indicate the levels that it's at, and one is non-detectable in background, which is what we would expect to see under normal conditions, and then from there it goes into a category called very low, and then medium and high. And when we start to see, even at the very low level, which to just give you an indication is up to 10,000 cells per liter, we can still start to see some of the effects. And in fact, at 5,000 cells per liter is when shellfish beds are typically closed, because the shellfish can accumulate those cells.
So where are we at now?
Well, it varies. We're everywhere from non-detectable up to high as far as the recent counts go. It's kind of spread all along the coast from Pinellas County down. I think there's been some high counts, or at least some elevated counts in Collier County, and even in some of the bays, like in Sarasota Bay.
Mm-hmm. So there's another thing that people see out on the water sometimes, and it's called red drift algae, and it's kind of visible. Can you explain the difference between that and what we're talking about today with red tide?
Sure. And the confusion there is because of the use of the word red.
Yep.
So when we talk about red tide, it's called that, and even scientists use that moniker, although it's not very accurate because the water is not always discolored at all, and certainly not always red, and it has nothing to do with the tide. But that is a name that stuck. So red drift algae is completely different. It's dealing with various species of macroalgae, which are, you know, larger, visible, multicellular algae that are often benthic growing attached to the substrate, and they can get loosened from wave currents or from storms, and then they float on top of the water. That can get washed into harbors and canals, and if it sticks around, and on beaches, and if it sticks around for a long time, it can start to degrade and smell bad. But it is not toxic, it is not harmful in the way that Karenia brevis red tides are.
Yeah, well, the layperson like me might see something like that and or smell something like that and think, oh my gosh, it's red tide right there, I can see it, I'm calling the scientists. So it's kind of nice to draw a delineation as to what the difference is between the two.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that can discolor the water, and we often, when there is anything going on, either heavy red drift or a red tide, or there's another marine cyanobacteria called Trichodesmium. It's also referred to as sailor sawdust or sea sawdust because of the granular appearance it has on the surface of the water. We often get calls asking about, is this an oil spill or is this red tide? So there are a lot of subtleties to what we see happening in the marine environment.
Is there any reason why it's so strong right now?
I'd like to say that, you know, there's a typical time of the year when the the blooms tend to occur, and there generally is, although it can bloom any time of the year. But we often, when we do see a bloom, an extensive bloom, we often see it, well, we first notice it in September, and it can persist into the winter, into January and February.
So when you say bloom, is it one large bloom, or is it a bunch of little pockets of blooms?
Well, that's a good question. It does tend to be very patchy, so you can literally have an area of very high concentration in one area and adjacent to that have either very low concentration or even non-detectable. It can be extremely patchy. We do believe it's all, when we have a bloom occur, such as is occurring now, that it is all part of the same bloom. So these cells aren't necessarily accumulating and growing in place. They could be growing over a widespread area, and then they can be pushed together by currents. And that's part of why we see that patchiness.
I would think that would make the predictive aspect of this a little difficult as well.
Indeed. And that, of course, is one of the ultimate goals, is to be able to better predict, you know, either predict if there's going to be a bloom, or when we do have a bloom, try to forecast where that bloom is going to go.
And Dr. Barron, with Croat, are you seeing this year as particularly bad?
Yes, this has definitely been a very busy year. And I think one thing that you have to appreciate is that sea turtles and seabirds are capable of moving long distances. So just because you have a heavy bloom in one area, it may not necessarily mean that that's going to be, we're going to find all the animal casualties. Certainly dolphins or other marine mammals may travel great distances after ingesting a meal where they obtain the toxin. So it's not uncommon for us to see birds, for example, that were maybe exposed all the way up towards Sarasota, but they don't begin to show clinical signs until they sort of get down in our area. And so, there's not always great correlation between where the bad blooms are occurring and where you're seeing animals that are affected. But certainly, if we do have a large number of animals that are affected, we always make sure that we let local officials know so they can go out and measure the amount of algae in the water so that if necessary, they can impart that to human health officials so that any warnings can be put out for people not to eat the shellfish in that area. So it's a really important part of what we call the One World, One Health concept, which is we all have this interrelationship that live on the earth. So between human health, environmental health, and animal health, whether wild or domestic, we're all, you know, have this one world, one health concept, and we're all part of what we call conservation medicine. And so if we do see a large number of animals that are affected by red tide, we definitely make sure that our local conservation organizations or Moat Marine knows and is aware.
So you just report we have a lot of these animals showing up. They're kind of like the canary in the coal mine, unfortunately,
exactly.
Though.
Exactly. Yes, that's exactly right. And I think that that's one of the really important things that wildlife veterinarians can do is monitor the health of local wildlife, because it can tell you so much about the health of the environment. But if nobody's watching the canary in the coal mine, then that doesn't help you. And that really is one of the primary missions at Crow, is to be on the front lines protecting the health of you, your pets, your food supply, and our environment, as well as the health and welfare of our local wildlife.
We are talking about red tide along the Gulf Coast. Call in and tell us what you're seeing. Is it impacting your life, how you work or play in the waters here in Southwest Florida? Give us a call. Share your thoughts or experiences at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Share on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Tag your questions with the hashtag GCL. Now, we were talking about this as a neurotoxin. So when the animals ingest it, is a neural response, is what you were saying.
That's correct. Really, we can see animals who are affected by red tide be affected in one of three primary ways. So if they ingest the toxin, that toxin does affect the nerves, and we can see central nervous system signs such as severe depression or even coma. We can also see local effects of the toxin in the gut itself. So you can have really bad tummy upset, so vomiting, diarrhea, that kind of thing. And then potentially, the toxin can also be aerosolized. So as the waves break on the beach, they can often aerosolize these toxins. And then if people or their pets or wildlife breathe those toxins in, then they can potentially present with respiratory difficulties. So a lot of coughing. In some cases, we even have animals who are so badly affected, they're actually coughing up blood. So, and these toxins can be particularly harmful for people or animals who already have respiratory disease or difficulty. For example, in humans with asthma, they can be affected for much longer than if they're just walking along the beach.
Well, it's dangerous when you're breathing it, but Dr. Lovko, let me ask you, is there a possibility of humans ingesting this particular toxin from red tide?
Yes, ingestion in humans typically happens through consuming shellfish that have accumulated cells. Shellfish, a lot of them are filter feeders, so they're filtering small particles out of the water. When there's a large bloom, those particles are going to be primarily Carinia brevis, so they accumulate in the digestive tract of shellfish. And so when we consume the shellfish, we're typically eating the entire thing, so we're eating the guts and those accumulated cells. And that can also happen in animals. Animals can eat these shellfish as well. And there's also filter feeding fish, planktivorous fish such as menhaden, that can accumulate the cells. And then when other animals eat those fish or eat the shellfish, they can get that blast of toxin as well.
And then that would have more of the neurological effect as opposed to the respiratory effect.
Right. So the respiratory effects occur when the toxins get aerosolized. So the seawater aerosols are formed in several ways and occurring all the time. It's basically a microscopic droplet of water. That droplet of water is going to contain the same substances that are in the water. So when there's a lot of brevetoxins, that droplet will contain the brevetoxins. And so when we inhale those aerosols and those little droplets, then we're getting those toxins in our lungs and respiratory tract.
Well, we have a phone call coming in from Nancy in Sarasota, and she has a sister with a weakened immune system. Nancy, what would you like to ask?
Hi, I do. My sister's coming down for the Christmas holidays, and she'll stay into January. And her weakened immune system is due to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And she's doing okay, but like I said, it is weakened. And I'm wondering if it's going to be dangerous for her to go down to CSPP and walk along the beach.
I can address that if
sure.
you'd like. So her weakened immune system wouldn't necessarily make her any more susceptible to the effects of the toxin. So this isn't an infectious or contagious disease. This is a toxin. However, if she does walk along the beach and irritates her respiratory system with the toxins, then potentially she may be more susceptible to, for example, secondary bacterial infections. It's really something she should address with her own human physician. But in general, I wouldn't think she would be any more susceptible or have any worse problems with the toxin than the average person.
Well, that makes sense. And also to talk to her doctor definitely.
Absolutely.
Before going for that stroll. We had a couple of questions about what is causing it, and wondering, we have a commercial fisherman from Naples who tweeted into us wondering if red tide is connected to water releases from Lake O. And we also have Greg on the phone from Naples. He's wondering what percent of agricultural runoff and that kind of thing is affecting it. Greg?
Hi.
Tell us your question. What is your concern?
Well, exactly that. You summarized it. How much are pesticide and fertilizer runoff from agriculture into the river and then, of course, spilling into the Gulf, how much of that is contributing to the red tide blooms?
Dr. Lovko, is there any estimation as to how much that is impacting the red tide?
So it's a little more complicated than that. Our current understanding of red tide is that it actually initiates offshore, could be as far as 40 miles or more offshore and near the bottom, likely in response in response to some sort of nutrient event, but it's not likely to be a land-derived nutrient event because it's too far offshore. Then these cells are carried along bottom currents towards the shore where, if conditions are right, they can make their way to the surface, and that's when we start to see the expression of the bloom with the discolored water and the dead fish and so forth. Like any other phytoplankton or any other photosynthesizing organism that needs nutrients in order to carry out photosynthesis, they can use land-derived nutrients once they are at the coast, but it is very unlikely that those sources will initiate the bloom. Now, whether or not they can make the bloom last longer or be more intense, our current data just doesn't give us evidence for that. And primarily that's because there's a lot of other phytoplankton and other organisms that are utilizing those nutrients. So it's hard to separate out what Karenia is, what red tide is using versus the other phytoplankton.
So you're saying that the red tide forms so far off that it's in its formation stage, it's not affected by what's coming out of Lake
right.
O or any
very,
of those?
It's very unlikely that that land-derived nutrients would affect the initiation of a bloom. And once that bloom is closer to the coast, it can utilize whatever nutrients are present.
But it's just, you're saying it's hard to track that?
Right. It's hard to separate out those effects. And really the only way we can do that is with many years' worth of data when there are blooms and when there are not blooms. Nutrients are one of the things that we measure on our routine surveys.
Oh, okay.
So over time, that gives us an idea.
Yeah, an idea, but it's just kind of hard to get concrete on that.
Right.
We have another phone.
We do know that.
Yes?
Oh, sorry.
Sorry?
We do know that Karenia can utilize many different forms of nutrients, both the simpler forms or the inorganic forms that are often present in agricultural fertilizers, but also very complex organic forms of nutrients.
Okay. We have another call from Lisa in Port Charlotte. What would you like to ask, Lisa?
Well, I'm curious to know is if you were to find a sick manatee or dolphin or turtle, is there a course of action that can be taken once you make a call to the, I imagine, the DNR? Is there something that can be given to the animal to help it along to some sort of recovery?
So are you talking about a bird or a turtle that you suspect has been affected by red tide? What do you do while you're waiting for the official response?
Well, I'm just, is there anything that can be done medically for those animals that are suffering from the effects of red tide, or is it always fatal?
Okay, let me ask Dr. Barron.
So there are several things you can do. First of all, there is a 1-800 number that you can call for Florida Fish and Wildlife for stranded marine mammals, and they will sort of walk you through, depending on what species it is, what you might be able to do to help immediately then and there. For sea turtles, the most important thing is if they're sort of washing in the surf, that you actually go ahead and bring them up on land. Remember, they are reptiles, so they don't actually breathe water. They breathe air just like people do, and they are at risk of drowning if they're washing in the surf. And then, of course, again, it would be very important to call Fish and Wildlife right away. For any stranded seabirds who appear to be sick or acting abnormally, the ideal thing to do is call any of your local wildlife rescue centers, and they'll be able to walk you through what's the best thing to do for that particular animal. But in general, those animals are going to require hospitalization because there are many things that can encourage those animals to do better. So if you look at national survival rates for rehabilitation centers from around the world, the typical survival rate for these birds is somewhere around 25% to 33%. At Crow, we've actually gotten that survival rate up to 55%. However, we do very intensive medical management. So they're on, they have IV catheters, they get intravenous fluid support. If they're anemic, they would get a blood transfusion. If they're hypoproteinemic, they might get a plasma plasma transfusion. They often don't want to eat on their own and therefore need to have assist feeds. And all this is highly technical and would probably be fairly difficult for the average person to be able to offer that level of care. So the ideal thing is to get them to a wildlife rehabilitation center as soon as possible.
What is the number at Crow, the phone number?
The phone number at Crow is 239-472-3644, and we're actually open 365 days a year, so you can call us anytime and we'll be able to help you.
And walk through the situation, what you do. For example, from what I understand, the birds, if they're affected by red tide, they kind of appear to be sort of drunk and they're just kind of disoriented. What do you do with a bird like that if you wanted to then be able to take that bird into Crow?
So that's exactly right. And depending on the species of bird, their clinical signs may manifest a little differently. So some of them, cormorants, for example, do show a lot of dizziness and inability to sort of walk in a straight line, almost this drunken, staggering type behavior. But many other species of birds or sea turtles, for example, just may be found down, very depressed, have the inability to move. And then also you will see that a lot of times they lose their inhibition of people. So they may actually walk right up to you as though they're not afraid of you at all. The ideal thing is to first and foremost protect yourself, because many of these birds do bite. And you want to be careful about that. But in many cases, you can just throw a towel over them and then take them to the nearest rehabilitation center.
And Dr. Lovko on the phone, we had a question on Twitter coming in asking, how does the public report red tide? To whom do they report that?
Well, they can report incidents of red tide to Florida Fish and Wildlife and also to MOAT. We often get phone calls and emails. We have a website called the Beach Conditions Reporting System that's at visitbeaches.org, where you can both there's a contact button so you can let us know if you see any evidence of red tide or dead fish, and also that you can find out what beaches are being affected by red tide. And we also are on the cusp of, might be a little too soon to say this, but we're working on developing a citizen science red tide reporting smartphone app that should hopefully be released early next year.
That's really a great idea. Well, we will have the phone numbers to reach out to Crow or the Fish and Wildlife and Moat Marine for anybody that would like to do any reporting, or should you come in contact with an animal that's been affected. We will have those listed on our website at wgcunews.org. We have to leave our discussion on red tide right there. For more information on the red tides and the latest forecast, you can visit us, as I mentioned, at wgcunews.org and click on today's show. Thank you to our guests, Dr. Heather Barron from Crow, the Clinic for Rehabilitation of Wildlife, and from the Moat Marine Lab in Sarasota, a big thanks to Dr. Vince Lovko. I appreciate you both being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up in the second half of Gulf Coast Live, giving pets as gift used to be discouraged, but now shelters in Lee and Collier counties are asking you to consider shelter pets in your gift giving. What's behind the change and why shelter pets might just be the perfect gift? Coming up, I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.